your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CommunityProgressiveRadio.org. Our guest today is Michael Parenti. Michael is an internationally known award-winning author and lecturer. He is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. His highly informative and entertaining books and talks have reached a wide range of audiences in North America and abroad. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Pleasure to be here, thank you.
Well, tell us about your new book, The Face of Imperialism. The title seems pretty self-explanatory, but what's the content of your book?
Well, I try to make clear that imperialism and empire are not just a matter of people wanting power or gaining influence or that sort of thing, but that there are real material interests involved, that the function of empire is to make the world safe for the Fortune 500, to make the resources of the world accessible on the most profitable terms to the rich and powerful, to expropriate the land, the labor, the resources of various countries for the benefit and profit of a small investor class throughout the world. So in other words, empire is not just a matter of dominion or just a matter of power or pride or aggression for aggression's sake or power for power's sake. Empire is a very, very functional thing for the interests of a ruling class and an investor class. And so it's a very rational thing. And you find that any leaders or political movements that try to use the land, the labor, the markets, the capital of a country, try to use those for the development of the population or the society, those people who commit economic nationalism or self-defining, self-growing goals, they usually are targeted and they're knocked out. And I mean, Gaddafi was knocked out because he wouldn't let the IMF in. He would not let the big oil company back in. The resources of his country were used for the needs of the populace, and therefore he is to be demonized. And what happens then, anybody who steps out of line and doesn't do what the Fortune 500 wants is demonized as someone who is against American interests, harmful, and such. So that's what that's pretty much what the book is about. And it's a very consistent thing. It's a very clear and very consistent thing that certain leaders, whether they are democratically elected or military autocrats or whatever they are, certain leaders, if they throw their country open, the land, labor, the resources, the markets, and the like, if they throw it open to the international corporate interests on terms that are beneficial to those interests, those leaders will be called friends of America and the like. If they fail to do that, if they resist that, and if they stake out an independent course, one that is directing the resources toward the well-being of the people, they will be demonized. And once you demonize the leaders, this gives the U.S. license to bomb their country, attack them, all under the guise of humanitarian rescue and well-being and that sort of thing. And this has been the case again and again and again, and that's what we're seeing to this day.
What do you, what parallels to this do you have? I totally agree with you.
But what parallels do you, of this imperialism? And many people, especially people on the co-opted or left, I call them, say that imperialism is an old-fashioned word, and we shouldn't be using that word in relation to the U.S. But what parallels do you see with the, you know, places like Syria and Iran?
Well, exactly what I said. Syria and Iran and Iraq under Saddam Hussein and countries of that sort were committing economic nationalism. They were not throwing their countries open to the IMF. They were not bringing the oil companies back in. They were not laying themselves out for other interests. Saddam Hussein, when he was first recruited by the CIA, and he went in and killed or attempted to kill the elected prime minister of Iraq at the time, and opposed a government that was opposed to the oil companies and the like. He was Washington's poster boy. They loved him, and
that's right.
He was a reactionary. He was killing communists, socialists, constitutionalists, Democrats, and he even wiped out the whole left wing in his own Baathist party. And he, meanwhile, you know, was becoming the strong man and the friend of America. But then he started going his own way. He wanted a better deal on the oil quotas. He did not give the oil reserves back to the Western, the British and American oil companies. He kept it nationalized. He kept the whole country nationalized. Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense at the time, said, it's a Stalinist economy. It's like Stalin. I mean, meaning it was publicly owned. He kept giving support to Palestine rather than you know, hailing Israel as the great leader of the area. And once that happened, then the Western media and Western leaders, especially in the U.S., started to discover all sorts of fearsome and terrible things about him. The very same guy, suddenly he was seen as a murderer, worse than Hitler, and ready to maybe do ill through all of Europe and start attacking other countries. He had weapons of mass destruction that we think and we didn't know about. Of course, there was no evidence ever to find of the monstrous weapons that would give him a power to kill whole vast populations. So his country has been destroyed. I mean, more than half of the people of Iraq are either dead or in exile or homeless or devastated in one way or another. They have no communities left. They have no schools. They have no hospitals. No, I mean, it's just horrible what's happened to Iraq. And it used to be
From cancers and other diseases because of the poison and depleted uranium and birth
That's
defects
right.
from the children.
Yes, and birth defects galore are coming, just as the same thing you can still see in Vietnam from the Vietnam War. In fact, even worse with the third generation now, the stuff combines and there's more and more of it. Yeah, so that's what we have. We have a shattered country. If it tries to go its own way, it pays a supreme price. And meanwhile, the American people go along with it because they are told that this guy is worse than Hitler and Noriega was, that's what they said about him in Panama, and that's what they said about Gaddafi in Libya, and that's what they're saying about Assad in Syria, and it goes on. And they're even backing, Al Qaeda groups and mercenary and you guys will be doing the hit work and the dirty work in certain countries, and that seems to be okay. And here we had been told that Al-Qaeda was fighting to fight against these terrorists, but in fact we enlist the terrorists to attack governments, which are not called governments, of course, they're called regimes. The BBC. The BBC has never once referred to the Assad government, it was the Assad regime, the Gaddafi regime, the Saddam's regime. That's what we're... So that's what we're facing. And the word empire is perfectly good word. We have today a global empire of a scope and a reach. It's a neo-imperialism, if people call imperialism an old-fashioned word, you were saying. The term used now is neo-imperialism or neo-colonialism, which means we don't send Colonel Blimp in with his swagger stick and we don't occupy the country the way the British did with India for over 100 years, and with great wealth going to the British ruling class and the standard of living in India over that 100 years dropping by more than 50%. So direct expropriation of the country may not be at hand, but it's a neo-imperialism where you may even leave the country with the trappings of independence, but you expropriate their resources and their markets and their labor and the like.
Do you see? Of course, I see in my day-to-day activism and life not near as big of a movement against the empire as we did when Bush was president, but we've never really, I think, in a major way addressed empire. We haven't been anti-empire. We've been anti-war. And, of course, the wars might stop, but the empire is still continuing. I mean, they say the war in Iraq is over, but we both know that, like you just described, the devastation and the continuing occupation by not only U.S. troops, but huge embassies and oil companies and other corporations and things like that. But I see an acceptance on, you know, the Democrats, by the Democrats who were against this when Bush was president, but they say under the guise of humanitarian intervention, if I didn't want the U.S. to start bombing Libya, then I didn't care about the people of Libya, a lot of people, a lot of Democrats told me. And so talk about how they are spreading empire by using that term humanitarian intervention.
Well, it's being used again and again. It was used for Iraq. It was used in Libya, and it's the same thing that the U.S. is going into using Yugoslavia. The U.S. is going in because the wicked Serbs were slaughtering and killing the Bosniaks and the Croatians and the Kosovars. In fact, there were killings on all sides. The Croats and Bosnians were killing each other, and terrible fights. But the thing you do is you demonize the leader. You say Milosevic is another whatever monster. Stalin, he was democratically elected. You would never know that. And you justify intervention as a way of rescuing people from a wicked movement or a wicked leader, and you demonize them, just as I said, and they fall for it. Whether they fall for it, if it's a Democratic president, if it's a Clinton or an Obama, some of our liberal friends just simply turn out to be little neo-Colonel Blimps themselves and see that, suddenly feel that it's really necessary to have to go and rescue these poor people. And you rescue them by bombing them. You bomb them hard. You hit their utilities, as in Yugoslavia, their hotels, their housing projects, their schools. I saw all that when I went to Yugoslavia. out of the country, you break it up into pieces, you bring in new leaders from Princeton or Harvard or wherever they've been sitting comfortably in exile waiting for the day to go back and do as the U.S. wants them to do. And that's what we have. It's a very transparent and very, very consistent policy as to who you support and who you care as a friend and who you condemn as a devil and an enemy we must necessarily attack. I don't know. I know maybe 60 or 70 countries that have been attacked in that way, all through Latin America, Central Asia, Middle East, Far East, by the U.S. And the American public does not seem to get it. They don't seem to get it. They think their leaders are driven only by a compulsive desire to bring goodness and safety and happiness to other people. When George Herbert Walker Bush went to Somalia with American troops there, the people in America actually thought, including some of our political friends, who actually thought that George Herbert Walker Bush was compelled by famine. He said, there's a famine in Somalia, and I've got to go and feed the people. He didn't feed them. He brought in helicopter gunships, and he brought in people armed to the teeth. There was a famine going on in about 9 African countries. Why did he pick Somalia? It turned out that Somalia was also seen or discovered that about 3/4 of the country had oil reserves in it. And George Herbert Walker Bush wanted also to get American military presence in on the Horn of Africa and in Central Asia, in that whole area. But we had our people saying, America is being led now by George Herbert Walker Bush, whose great concern is that Somalian babies get enough to eat. What a joke. When did he ever give a goddamn about African children having enough to eat or not eat? They can't think ill of their own country, or the leaders of their own country.
Right. What do you think about the gun debate that's going on right now? I was watching CNN, and I call it CIANN, but I watch it for a little bit every day because I think it's legitimate to know the propaganda of the state, and so I watch it. But the commentator said that she believes that the people who are pro Second Amendment are and I'm talking about the legislators. I'm talking about Congress, who are fighting for the Second Amendment. She actually said that she believes that they are doing this based on principle, and I don't think Congress has any principles except who's coming in with the largest check. And so, what do you think about the gun debate as it relates to, maybe kind of like a distraction from the real issues or something?
I didn't quite get your question. What do I think was going on?
The gun debate, I think that, what do you think is behind right now, the huge issue of guns and gun violence.
Oh, gun control and such.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean. There are horrible incidents of murder that take place, and so Congress has to react with a show of concern and indignation and the like. I don't think they really are. I don't think most of the people in Congress care particularly much about other people and other people's needs and survival and humanity and quality of life. I think they care about opinion and interest and where they stand and how they look and how this influences their own fortune. So when you have a slaughter taking place in a school of six-year-olds and seven-year-olds, I mean, they have to act with indignation and rage.
Right.
And, of course, it's a very unsettling and very disrupting thing. The public itself is bothered by it. But at the same time, the gun lobby and the gun nuts do not see this as a time to have less guns, but they see such events and massacres as cause for people having more guns. That this justifies you having all those guns in your house. I mean, it's a country that has, you know, it's about 300 million guns, not counting ones that aren't that are hidden and unregistered and illegal and such. It's an insane kind of situation, and it's not a way of solving or bringing peace and security to the country. We know that social democracies, which are now getting ripped apart and shattered, but social democracies that had guns or fewer guns or more guns or whatever, but they had less killings. There was less unemployment. There was less people with shattered lives, with pointless lives, with lives filled with hurt and deprivation. And
also easier access to health care and mental, mental health care in those countries.
Right. There was more well-being, there was health care, there were social services for people to help them to make life more bearable. And so you were less likely to find people desperate who take a gun and go into an area where there's a congregation of unarmed people and start spraying them with death, you know. That's never looked at. The massacres are never looked at in terms of what is the quality of life, what is equity, what is the well-being of people in our own country. And that's why the murder rate in countries like Canada, which per capita have as many guns as in the U.S., or in countries like Japan or the Scandinavian countries, murders are really much less. Although we did see in Norway a horrible politically motivated murder long ago.
Right.
Yeah.
So, also, I would like to see some people caring about the children in places like Pakistan and Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and those places being murdered by U.S. foreign policy. You know, that's what happens in the United States is unfortunate and a real commentary on our society, but it pales in comparison to what people in other countries who, you know, we're occupying or bombing have to face on a daily basis.
Yeah, you mean those who are trying to stay alive with the drones coming over them and that sort of thing. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes. Weapons of terror, I think.
There's a terrorization of whole populations. We see this in Western Pakistan and we saw this in the Yugoslav bombing. We see this in the bombing of Libya and in a variety of other countries. It's the empire going full force, and it's keeping people in line. The people who are bombed are those countries, as I said, that they try to stake out their own fortune, their own well-being. And there's a conscious spreading of deprivation and of poverty. The poorer I can make you, the harder you will work for less and less on terms that are to me. The poorer I can make you, the less able you are to develop social organizations that can self-develop and serve your interests and keep out the predator interests that I have set up to come in and take over your country.
Well, and how brilliant are the imperialists when, you know, they can compare the CEO of Empire, Barack Obama, he can be compared to Martin Luther King Jr. He can get a Nobel Peace Prize, but at the same time expanding these racist imperial adventures.
Well, they're not stupid. They're very smart, I would say.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
They want a guy who's a gangster, but who can be pumped off to the American public as a man of peace and gets a Nobel Prize. I said that. I wrote an article on that too. By the way, I invite your listeners to go to my website, michaelparenti.org, and I have an article about the Nobel Peace Prize for War. I call it that. That the best Nobel Peace Prize is to be a war criminal. You know, Henry Kissinger, Nicholas Murray Butler, a whole bunch of people in movements, organizations, and Barack Obama. He was a guy who was bombing four countries, and they gave him the Nobel Peace Prize. He himself was a little embarrassed about it, it seemed, but because he really wants to show himself to be a tough guy. He's a guy who salutes with the grimness on his face. He salutes the coffins covered with the flag as they come back, and he's there talking about how he making sacrifices, and easy for him to talk.
Exactly.
And it's really repulsive. It's really terrible the way he carries on. And he serves well. I mean, look, a black guy too. Isn't that great? And,
he's an able servant of Empire. That's what I call him. He's an able servant of Empire. And
I like your phrase. Empire.
Michael, we're out of time. So can my listeners find out more information about your book, The Face of Imperialism, at your website, michaelparenti.org?
Yes, there's details on my website about the book, and the book's available. I think there are some bookstores, a few bookstores that are still left. We'll order a copy for you, or you can get it on Amazon. It's reviewed. There are people who have given reviews of it and the like. It's a quick read. It's only about 140 pages. Nice, readable type and all. It's called The Face of Imperialism. And my website is michaelparenti, one word, .org. And,
perfect, and I'll also link it on my website and the newsletter when I send out the notice about your show. I'll also have it linked for my listeners and supporters. So, Michael Parenti, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you, Cindy. Keep up all your wonderful work. You are a treasure to our side.
Thank you.
That's our soapbox for this week. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you learned something. I'd also like you to go to CindySheehanSoapbox.com and check out the new action that we're planning called Tour de Peace. It's a bike ride from California to Washington, D.C. to demand an end to this insanity called the U.S. Empire. And we're going to converge on D.C. on the 3rd of July, leaving here in Vacaville, California, on April 4th, which is the day my son and Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. So please go to my blog for more information, or you can email me at cindysheehansoapbox@gmail.com. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, with Community Progressive Radio, my producer, Mikey, Michael Parenti, for giving us his time today and being our guest, and especially you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.